This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm here at EWAS in Liverpool with Matt Taylor, who is the project scientist for the ESA Rosetta mission. I believe we've had you on before.
I believe so.
But for those that haven't met you or listened to you before, do you want to tell us quickly a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, sure. I'm a space plasma physicist, basically. So I'm a little out of place here because I normally focus more in the heliosphere and planetary aspects. My job in European Space Agency as a project scientist is to be the liaison between ESA and the scientific community to ensure that scientific community gets the science that they want from the missions. And I've been involved and still am involved in the Rosetta mission.
So for just sort of background story on the Rosetta mission, I believe it was launched in 2007 and then...
Oh, 2004.
2004?
Yeah, yeah.
And then...
Yeah, so basically it was a mission to the comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, which is a Jupiter-class comet, so it's got an orbit going out to Jupiter. We launched in 2004 and took 10 years to get to the comet because it's difficult to go deep space. And yeah, the last, I would say, probably 3 years, well, since 2014 when we arrived at the comet, were exciting and stressful. And I think I took the last year. So the mission ended in 2016. So I think I took 2017 to recover, and many of us did recover, hopefully, from the rollercoaster ride that it was. So operations went ahead and we did all of the stuff that we wanted to do and more. And some things didn't go right, some things went right, some things were unexpected, some things were expected. And now we're in the process of ensuring that all the data is secured away in the archive so anyone can look at the data, anyone can do the science that was the reason that we sent Rosetta to this comet.
Okay, so what was that science? What were the main scientific objectives?
Well, this was to characterise this comet, to really get an understanding of how comets work, because all previous missions to comets have been flybys, very quick little snapshots, and then you go from quite great distance. Rosetta was designed way back in the 80s, in fact, when Giotto was flying past Comet Halley. Already then it was identified that this was the thing we needed to do. We needed to sit next to a comet, because a comet's a very active object. When it's close to the sun, it's very active, so the ice within it sublimates and you get the formation of these fantastic dust and gas tails. When it goes further away, it becomes rather inert. We wanted to see how that process worked. So that's what the investigation was really focused on. And, well, let me step back a bit. The comets are kind of, alongside the other small bodies of the solar system, like asteroids, are like the leftover bits of the formation of the solar system. So looking at those gives you an idea of what went into the solar system at the beginning. So I would say some of the great stuff that's come out of Rosetta is at the molecular level, like the stuff that's come off, some of the gases indicate, well, constrain the formation mechanisms of the solar system itself. So one example I'll jump straight with is the discovery of molecular oxygen on the comet or within the comet, which was a massive surprise because oxygen is a very friendly molecule. It likes to get with other molecules. Finding oxygen by itself, it's only possible to be there under certain situations, and you extrapolate backwards and it then constrains how the comet was put together, the temperature of the dust and gas cloud that was there before the sun was formed. So there's stuff in the comet that predates the formation of the sun itself. So that's, I find, quite mind-blowing. So it's really giving you this view back into the beginning of the solar system and what the situation was like there.
So does this have implications on, say, for instance, the origins of water on Earth?
Or... Well, that's another one of the things that we were looking at 67P, where you have this view. Well, we believe that the water on Earth, or the Earth was devoid of water in the early phases. Something must have brought that back. And we were looking at asteroids and comets as maybe being the most viable delivery mechanism. From what we found with Rosetta and 67P, the water on the comet was nothing like that we find on Earth.
How so?
We would look at the ratio of heavy water, or deuterium to hydrogen, and doing that comparison shows that for this particular comet, and we group that with other comets, it's very different. It suggests that that measurement or that ratio, that flavour of water, suggests that the comet was formed very, very far away from the sun. So going back to the delivery of water question, it suggests that comets aren't really a major delivery mechanism. We don't believe they are. However, there are other things that we found on the comet, in particular some of the noble gases. There's a set of xenon isotopes that we can really look at and use as a kind of tracer and a marker. And the stuff that we find on the comet is very similar to that of the atmosphere of the Earth. So you can say, well, maybe water wasn't delivered, or that much water, but there are other things that were delivered that could have supplied a significant amount of the Earth's atmosphere. And then when you find glycine, so a precursor of proteins, on the comet as well, maybe comets delivered some of the more complex stuff that then went on to become life. So they're a way of potentially delivering the building blocks of life to our early Earth.
Okay, so and these comets are definitely from within our solar system. There's no way that they could be sort of a Oumuamua type.
Some of the other discoveries we've been looking at, really, the comet is so unsolar-like. When you look at all of these, the sulfur, the silicon, the xenon, and all, they don't look solar. But it also then links to, there are some other observations of, I've forgotten the name of the constellation now. Sorry, my brain's gone. But
it's been a long week.
Yeah. But looking when, this is the thing. You can take the Rosetta, our solar system observations, and then compare them to other planetary or young star systems, and we have made observations, the community, of these protosolar or protostellar protoplanetary nebula, and you have this very irregular mix of dust and gas around early systems, and that might be what happened in our solar system. It wasn't a nice homogenized mix. It was all over the place. It was lumpy. Some dust was of a certain size in one part of the solar system and different in another part, and that's the nature of science, I guess, that what we're finding is that it isn't as easy as we thought it was, or as simple the formation process is, and that there was a bit of a weird mix of stuff. So going back to, we don't think that this is an alien object, but it's indicating that some of the more simple ideas of how the solar system formed need to be rethought, and you can actually connect these measurements and these observations to other planetary systems as well. So that's the broad-based impact of Rosetta, is that you've got in situ in the solar system that you can compare to other astronomical observations as well, which is nice.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about what I think was, for the community at least, the most nerve-wracking part of the mission, mm-hmm. which was the bounce.
Right.
How did that happen? How did it feel?
It's a long time ago now, but I have to say, trying to stay positive through that entire week was very difficult, but there was a feeling that it was going to work anyway. The reason, Phil, I didn't stay where it was supposed to, you can go in different directions here, but it was good that it didn't. Well, one thing, I'd say that it's good that it didn't remain where we targeted, because where we ended up was actually much more interesting from a scientific point of view. When we eventually found the lander and took that final image in September, there was no dust on it, so it's giving us another indication of the weirdness of this cometary object, that some places had loads of dust delivered, other places didn't have any. There was no dust backfall. In fact, if Philae had stayed where it was, there's a high likelihood that it would have got completely covered with dust backfall. Right, okay, so it was nerve-wracking. We had three ways of securing ourselves to the comet. There was a gas thruster on the top of the spacecraft to try and push it down whilst it was firing harpoons, and he had some mechanical eye screws as well. We knew the night before that the gas thruster wasn't going to work, but we thought, well, we'll deliver it anyway, given this set of criteria, and the harpoons will stop it from disappearing back into the ether, as it were, space. The harpoons didn't work, and so that's why we got the bounce. Luckily, some of the mechanics of the system reduced the momentum enough to stop it from flying off completely, but we skipped about a kilometre across the surface of the comet. The reason we believe the harpoons didn't work was, if you go out, you get some fireworks, and you leave them outside or, in your garden for 10 years, and then try and light them, they might not go off. So we think what it was is the long space voyage for 10 years affected the pyrotechnics. That's effectively what it was. And there was already some investigation just prior to the landing in the pyrotechnics and the fuse mechanism to try and see what needed to be done, because we had some ground-based stuff that we'd left on the ground to test. And it looked like that's probably what happened. It was just basically a damp powder, for want of a better phrase, if the fuse didn't trigger properly. But as I was saying and waving my hands a lot about, we ended up somewhere much more rich, I think. And it just added to the story that was Rosetta, the fact that we had this, that the lander was stuck in a ditch. We didn't get an image until the month before we ended the whole mission. And that ubiquitous image that I received on a Sunday night from one of my colleagues, and Chechi Tubiana, who works on the camera team, she found that. She was poring over the data, and then there's this the fantastic story of her finding it, they're rushing into work at MPS, and that percolation of that information within the team, me getting it on my phone in the evening and waking my wife up and going, they found it, and then getting so excited because we'd been looking for it for that long, and that is the only image that we got, because it was a crazy time when we were spiraling down towards the comet at the end of September 2016. The gravity of that object is so weird that we had a 3-day fixed orbit, and depending how we were overflying through our pericenter was dropping down to about 2 kilometers from the surface. It would affect the orbit period by up to 20 hours in one direction. So we had to correct that. So we tried to stay as close to 3 days orbit period as possible, because I think at the time it was something like half an hour one way light time. We were doing everything ahead of time, programming our operations ahead of time. So to have a time shift in that meant that you'd be taking an image or a measurement at the wrong time and wrong place. So that's why we had to fix it like that. That's why it's actually so challenging to get that image. When I give my presentation, I show, I think, an orbit before that image that we got. We were offset. This is rubbish for a podcast.
We might cut this.
There's
we
a
might
square.
Not.
if this is your image and you're looking in the middle, we were completely off center by a good few degrees because of this shifting. And then there was a frame about 20 seconds after, and it was when the comet had rotated a little bit and the spacecraft had moved, and you could actually see the lander leg sticking above the horizon, as it were. But you couldn't say that's definitely a lander. Nobody would believe that. Then we got that one. It's nothing but the lander. And then that was it. We weren't able to capture another image for various reasons. So, yeah, it just adds to that narrative that was Rosetta.
So did you get all the data back down from Philae
now?
Yeah,
from Philae we got everything that we expected, and from Rosetta we got everything that we expected, and that's the key, that's the ongoing activity. So yeah, we finished in 2016, but we are continuing our activities within ESA at least up until September next year. The teams out in the community are still working on this, getting the data in the archive, as I said at the beginning, so that everyone can use this data. And it's been a long and difficult task, because it's difficult data to get processed and calibrated in a really good way.
Okay, so just finally, looking beyond Rosetta, have you got anything plans ESA-wise?
No.
Or have you got any missions that you're particularly looking forward to seeing?
Well, I mean, the big one for me is, because I work at ESTEC in Noordwijk in the Netherlands, and we have Bepi Colombo in-house, and it's about to leave to go to the launch site at the end of this month. It's going to fly out in 4 Antonovs and a massive barge from Rotterdam as well. That, to me, that's a cool mission, although, you know, it gets launched this year, but then it's going to take 6 or 7 years to get to Mercury. That's a really nice-looking spacecraft, so I'm quite excited about that.
So that's a Mercury lander?
Mercury orbiter. There's 2 spacecraft. One's a magnetospheric-type mission, one's more of a planetary mission. And it's a collaboration with the Japanese Space Agency as well, which adds, I think, an extra dimension to this. It's fantastic to have this international collaboration, because that's what it's all about. Okay, so that's from an ESA perspective what I'm interested in, but I'm not involved in that mission. I'm waiting for management to give me something to do. And we see, well, we know within the next month they're going to down select some missions for study at the M-class level. And there might
what
be
is
some,
that? What's
so
M-class?
Got M, right, you've got M, L, S. They're all different cost caps for different missions. So Bepi Colombo is more like an L-class. Solar Orbiter is an M-class mission. So they're about $500-600 million is an M-class budget, roughly, depending on which call it was. So that kind of size mission is, there'll be a call for a mission, what was the M5 then? We just had the M4 down selection, so the Ariane mission was selected, which is going to characterise exoplanet atmospheres. Yeah, as I say, so next month, May time, we'll find out some more studies that will be put in for about 2 years, and I might be put on, if there's a suitable mission, I might be involved in one of those. Gunter Hassinger just gave a presentation here at EWAS, and also spoke about F-class missions, which are smaller ones, but what they'll try and do is they'll add them to the launch of these M-class missions to get a launch for free. So there might be some interesting possibilities there. And he was mentioning the possibility of this being focused on maybe the planetary area, so the planetary science. So there's some stuff for me to do and keep me busy, I think.
All sounds very exciting. Matt Taylor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for listening to me warble on after the conference dinner as well.